Hello and welcome. I'm Sofiko and this is Creative Minds Speaking, a podcast where I have conversations with creative industry professionals, bringing into the spotlight those incredible people who are behind the scenes of art and entertainment is the main goal of this podcast. The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are the personal views of the guests only and do not represent in any way the views of their companies. This is an exploration of the guest's journey and views only. On today's episode, I'm going to chat with Jem Aswad. He's a senior music editor at Variety. He's a very well-known journalist in the music industry, and I'm super happy to have him on the show. Welcome to the podcast, Jem.
Well, thank you, Sophie Coe. That's a rather inflated introduction. I'm not super well-known, but thank you.
You are. Of course you are. So let's start with your background. Can you please tell us a little about yourself and how did you start your career in the entertainment industry?
Well, that's more than a little story. I'll start. I guess it all began when I was about 1 year old and I would stand up in my crib and yell for a song. And then I just got obsessed with records when I was very little, and I scratched up one of my mother's Joan Baez records when I was 3 or 4 trying to play it on the record player. And then when I was 5 or 6, she brought home the Beatles Sgt. Pepper album, and I just got obsessed with the Beatles. And the following year, she brought, you know, like I'm drawing pictures of them and pretending to play guitars and stuff like that, started taking guitar lessons, but never really got, I could tell I wasn't ever going to be great. Maybe a year after she brought home the Beatles album, she brought home a rock encyclopedia from the library. I just read it and read it and read it and read it. Would look at the music magazines when we went to the supermarket. And when I was 7, she took me to my first concert. It was a group called The Byrds, who of course did Mr. Tambourine Man. This was pretty late in their career. She, my mother dressed me too. Like she had me in this sort of psychedelic shirt with a brown suede fringe vest, and my hair was long for a boy at the time. Everybody thought I was a girl. So it was really those three things that started it off. And if you think about it, it's kind of like my fate was sealed right then, because, you know, in high school, I started writing about music for the high school newspaper and started working in the record store I'd been hanging out in since I was 12. And then I did the same thing in college, you know, went to Syracuse, New York, which is maybe an hour from where I grew up, and immediately found the music scene and immediately found the record stores and basically sort of majored in music business without really knowing what it was, because back then there were no music business programs in colleges. You couldn't major in it. There weren't even classes. So you kind of had to figure it out on your own. After college, I spent a year trying to be a real reporter and didn't have any luck. So I went to a postgraduate program that a friend of my mother's had recommended. And there I met someone who had been an editor at Hit Parader magazine and a couple of heavy metal magazines. And we worked together on a fake magazine, you know, that was part of the publication, the publishing program. And she liked what I did. And she recommended me for a job as soon as we got out. And I moved to New York. And it was at a teen heavy metal magazine called Faces Rocks. And I hadn't really liked heavy metal since I was several years younger, but it was a music job. The other job offers I had were like, you know, House and Garden magazine and like book publishing companies and things. So I did it. And the next 5 or 6 years, I was working in heavy metal. Not always at that magazine. I left there after a few months and I ended up at a company called CMJ, which is college radio version of Billboard. So we worked with a lot of up and coming artists. You know, grunge was happening at the time. I was still working in heavy metal. I was the heavy metal editor, but I got the first Soundgarden EP and I was like, oh, I understand this. It's metal and alternative. So I sort of like built my career on grunge, which paid off really well when Nirvana hit it big. And by that point, alternative was so big that even I could get an A&R job at a major record company, which I did. I did A&R for 3 or 4 years, hated it, absolutely hated it. Everybody had been saying to me, you've got such great ears, you should do A&R. Well, doing A&R has really not all that much to do with your ears necessarily. It's about business. And it's about getting to the artists who are going to be big as soon as you can and signing them to a your company under terms that often are very disadvantageous to the artist. I didn't feel great about that either. And I just wasn't good at it. So, you know, I eventually realized that I belonged in editorial. I got back into editorial. And the advantage, because my years at record companies, and I also worked for ASCAP, they were not a success. But they're what made me a good music business reporter. Because I understand the music business. I've done those jobs or some of those jobs. I can talk about publishing. I can talk about record company contracts. I can talk about sponsorships and things like that more than the average music writer can. Because there are an awful lot of great music writers out there. There are very few good music business writers. And that's what's enabled me to differentiate myself for the later part of my career. And I've worked almost everywhere. I have worked at Time Out New York Magazine. So there's the magazine world. I've worked at MTV News. I've worked at Billboard twice. I was the editor-in-chief of Spin. That was another disaster. And I've been at Variety for the last 4 years with my boss, Shirley Halperin, who we started working together at Billboard. We've worked together closely for 7 years. She's awesome. She's the greatest boss I've ever had, along with my former boss at ASCAP, who is also wonderful. And she's created a space for us to amazingly cover the music business, but write about music at the same time. Because like I can do cover, you know, I do deep music industry coverage, but I also do cover stories on Bruce Springsteen and Phoebe Bridgers and Megan Thee Stallion. And I've got one coming up next week on the artist Her. So it's been really exciting and really fun. And I can't believe how lucky we've been. So that's a long-winded answer to your question.
Okay, so and after all this, you are telling me that you're not a very well-known music journalist? Seriously?
I'm not. Whatever.
Okay, so what is like to work at Variety? Maybe you can tell us how your regular day at work looks like and what are your main responsibilities there?
Well, one thing I'll say is since COVID started, most people have become a lot more productive. Those of us who are lucky to be working anyway, because you don't have anything else to do. And, I crank my day. Okay. My average day, I get up 7:30 or so, check my phone to see if there's breaking news that I have to jump on straight out of bed, which I had to do twice last week. And they're not like, David Bowie dies kind of stories. Usually it'll be something like, you know, for example, last week, Reservoir, a music company, purchased the catalog of Tommy Boy Records, an iconic hip hop label from the 80s and 90s, for $100 million. And, you know, I see this on my phone. I jump up. I said, I got hold of the SEC filing, found out it was for $100 million. Wow, that's a big story. I had something up in 15 minutes. And filled it out for the next hour or two. And there was my story. I'm publishing an average of 4 to 10 to 12 stories a day. Needless to say, I am not enormously proud of all those stories because you have to do them very quickly. but, you know, there are the ones that we go, you know, that we go very deep on. I did one recently called Inside the Dirty Business of Hit Songwriting that I'm really, really pleased with because I really dug in. I talked to like 8-10 different people for it. I talked to contemporary songwriters. I talked to songwriters from the 60s and 70s. I talked to people who knew details about Elvis Presley's arrangement with his songwriters, whereby if he performed one of your songs, he got a third. He got a third of it. He didn't write any of the song and he still got a third of it. And that kind of thing still goes on because a lot of songwriters are just so, they can't turn away the opportunity, even though they're giving up a certain amount of money. And that's the sort of thing you do once. The first time, you know, to get your name out there, and then hopefully you don't have to do it again. But a lot of big artists are insisting on it. And, you know, so that's one sort of cause that I really dug into. Another one is Save Our Stages, the difficulty that concert venues have been having in the United States, independent concert venues, not the big ones that are owned by AEG and Live Nation. I did a lot on live streaming when it was looking like that was the only way that we were really going to have be able to have concerts for the foreseeable future. And that moved forward pretty dramatically for a while. But then it kind of, people were just like, oh, concerts are coming back soon. And a lot of places in the United States, there already were concerts, you know, because there is no national policy for COVID safety in the United States. It's state by state, and some states don't care. And other states do. So there have been a lot of things like that that I've been diving into. But I try using our platform because it's a big platform. And when Shirley and I started in April of 2017, Variety hadn't had a full-time music reporter, or at least department, for 20 years. Wow. And we pretty quickly not only put it on the map, but became leaders in it. We're not the best, you know, all right, I do think we're the best, but we're not the biggest. And we certainly don't have the biggest staff, because the music staff is just three of us. Billboard has probably 20 something. Rolling Stone has 20 something. And those are our main competitors. And we don't, you know, we turn out almost as much material, and we certainly break as many stories. So I'm very proud of what we do. But we keep it at scale, you know, and because of that, because we don't spend a ton of money compared to some of the other publications, where it's also been financially beneficial to our parent company, PMC, Penske Media Corporation, which also owns Billboard, Music Business Worldwide, and Rolling Stone. So, or partially owns them. So that's it. Yeah.
That's incredible. I didn't know that it's just three of you at the department. That's crazy. Yeah.
Yes,
and
it is.
when you say that, like, you wake up at 7:30 and you get all this news, what's the way of you getting all this information? Do you get a bunch of press releases, or how it functions?
Well, it's both. Mostly what I'm looking at is I'm looking at my email and, you know, and my Twitter lists. I've got a music list. I've got a music biz list. I've got a news list. You know, I've got various lists and all that. And it's really those things. And we also have internal Slack, because Shirley stays up late and she's on the West Coast. So there will often be notes from her, like, can you follow this up? Can you post this in the morning? Can you look into this? You know, because a lot of the things she's curious about, she can't check up on, because here it's 5 o'clock in the morning in New York, and there it's 2. So those are the main things. But it can come crashing in from anywhere. And even as plugged in as we try hard to be, you still miss things. They just fly off of your radar, or a story will break in some, you know, in some publication you're not really following, or some big one. A story will break on CNN. And if I subscribe to CNN's Twitter feed, there'd be nothing else in there. So, you know, we just stay on top of it as best we can. And even though you get, like, scolded sometimes for missing something or whatever, everybody knows you can't be everywhere.
Yeah, definitely. I also wanted to talk about the interviews that you're doing.
Yes.
Can you share, how do you prepare yourself for all these interviews?
All right. If I were to give advice to journalists, the main thing to do is to try to read as much as you can about your subject. Duh. I mean, obviously, that's something you're going to do. But you have to be selective about what you're reading. You get so you can recognize an authoritative voice. You get so you, and an authoritative source, which, depending on who it is, you look for the main reliable sources are places like the New York Times or Billboard or Variety or Rolling Stone and places like that, big publications. But depending on who you're reporting on, they may not be covering them. They may not be covering them in depth. So you try to dig a little deeper into the publications that specialize in the part, the area of who you're researching. For example, I did a cover story on Phoebe Bridgers, the singer-songwriter. I did not look at CNN. I did not look at the New York Times. I went deep on Pitchfork and alternative music press and stuff like that. Same thing with Megan Thee Stallion. I went deep in the hip hop press and I looked all over her social media. That is another key thing. You obviously, so much of an artist or a person's profile is in their social media feed. Sometimes you find things there that you're just like, whoa, maybe weren't covered in the CNN story or whatever. It's about that. You figure out what the obvious questions are, and then you think about what the not so obvious questions are. What is something that was maybe hinted at in a different article? You want to get hold of the press releases and the official bios and things like that, because even though they're presenting a very they're putting the information that they want out there, you can be astonished sometimes at the things that are left out of official bios, you know, racist accusations or being arrested, you know, for drunk driving and things like that. But it's helpful to know what those are. And also, like, if you find out, like, okay, you know, like arrested for drunk driving 4 years ago, I didn't see that anywhere else. That may not be a question you ask, but it keeps people on their toes and it lets them know that they can't take advantage of you. Mm-hmm. So it's both working with and kind of working against their official handlers to get the best possible story. And I always try to get them off of their usual talking points and just like ask them about something from a long time ago or something that they, you know, they maybe haven't talked about as much. And that doesn't, they don't always bite. You know, they're not always interested or engaged or want to talk about these things necessarily, but it can really open up an interview. You know, mm-hmm. like just for an example, I interviewed Mark Anthony, the Latin singer from New York. And like very early in his career, he had worked with this amazing DJ combo called Masters at Work. And I hadn't known that. I was just like, pretty early in the interview, I was just like, oh, I hadn't realized you worked with Masters at Work as much as you did early in your career. And it turned out that like he hadn't planned to be a Latin singer. He had planned to be an English language speaker, but he sort of did a Latin song just like on off the cuff. And it was a huge hit that he wasn't expecting. And he's like, oh yeah, man. Like, you know, I sang like 100 songs with Masters at Work. And he's talking. He's like, man, I haven't thought about this stuff for years. And it made for such a great interview with somebody who I really didn't know all that much about. So it's like the offbeat questions can really go a long way. Like I said, they don't always work, but when they do, they tend to work really well.
That's such a great advice. Thank you for sharing. And how do you usually take all these interviews? Do you usually do them online, offline? Obviously, I guess now it's mostly online, but before
COVID
times?
We do Zoom. You know, most of them are Zoom. We do a lot of phone calls. I'm fine with phone calls. I'm old, you know, younger generations generally don't seem to be as comfortable talking on the phone a lot of the time. They're used to typing and thumbing, whatever. People from my generation, you're just like, if the emails or the texts are getting out of control, you just pick up the phone. What are you talking about? You know? But the genuine back and forth, real conversation is the best thing. And being in person with someone is the best thing. You pick up their body language. You see the way they're dressed. There are so many that you get their whatever chemicals we human beings feel. You know, I mean, that really is a way to a better way to get a sense of somebody than over the phone or over virtual.
Yeah, definitely. And what is your most favorite and least favorite part of your job?
My favorite part is writing something I love. And I'm so lucky to be able to say in the last few years, especially at Variety, and I always knock on wood when I say this, it's the best job I've ever had. And this is late in my career, so it's amazing. writing something, getting a great scoop. You know, there have been a few of those. The Songwriter Story had a bunch of good scoops in it. I uncovered a bunch of stuff about the Recording Academy and some of their questionable policies that were good scoops. That's our stock in trade is news scoops. But just as rewarding is a good profile of somebody. You know, I did the Bruce Springsteen cover story I did. And I'm not a huge, huge Bruce Springsteen fan. I mean, I love his Born to Run album. I like a lot of his other music. But I'm not a geek, you know. And I think that made for a better interview because I wasn't starstruck and I wasn't asking him really deep, like, you know, like, oh, in 1975 you played, bleh, you know, questions like that. And because I had never interviewed him before, most of the people who interview him have, and because I wasn't a huge fan, I got a lot of different answers out of him. And now I knew some super fans and I grilled them very heavily before I did this interview to find out things, good things to ask about or whatever. But he hadn't talked about Trump much and I got him to talk about Trump. And one question that was really revealing was I said to him, there are these two songs that he sings with his wife when he performs. And they were released before they were together around the same time. And I said to him, did you have her in mind when you wrote those songs? Was she in your life at that time? Because when you sing them, it sounds like they were written for her. And he's like, maybe they were, you know? So like little things like that, you just see the clouds parting and you get so mm-hmm. happy. So that is what I love. Writing something I really love, getting a great story, whether it's a scoop or just somebody opening up or something that I just feel is really, really well written or funny. I did a story yesterday. The George Harrison estate sent out promotional gnomes. Okay. Little plastic garden gnomes from, the cover of George Harrison's first solo album, he's sitting in a garden and he's surrounded by these little statues of gnomes. So they sent out promotional gnomes and like nothing else because they knew that people would know that that meant a 50th anniversary of the album reissue was coming. So, and that story got a great reaction. It was just funny because I worked my family into it and stuff like that. So those are the best moments. The worst moments are, on the one hand, the drudgery of having to write just because it's the internet and we have to keep the site moving and clicks and page views and clickbait and blah, blah, blah. And you have to write some really stupid, boring stories that make you just like, I went to college for this. I'm like, you know, I'm what Sofiko Karasalidze, did I say it right?
Yes.
Yes. What she said is a well-known journalist, and here I am writing this asinine clickbait. So on the one hand, that is a downside. A more serious downside is bad news and sad news and disgusting news, like covering R. Kelly. Okay, the things that R. Kelly allegedly did to young women are unconscionable. And it's, you know, things like that make me really, really upset. And things like that are the reason I'm an entertainment reporter, because I don't want to report on things like that. I don't want to report on war and starving children and sexual abuse and things like that. So things like R. Kelly, when I was at MTV News, it was Michael Jackson as well. I can't stand writing about that stuff. I just can't stand it. So, but I do because I have to. But those are the downsides.
That's sad. I never honestly thought about it, but I can't even imagine what it's like to write about all this.
I mean, your face is being rubbed in it, you know. Or when I was at MTV News, we didn't just do entertainment, and there was a big shooting. I mean, there are big mass shootings in the United States almost every day, but there was a big one at Virginia Tech University in I think 2008 or 2009. And it was just horrifying. And just when we thought it was over, this FedEx package from the shooter arrived and he was like, you had so many chances. He had a video in it and all these pictures and the whole thing flared up again and stuff like that. When it's in your face all the time, you just want to hide. But again, I'm not a doctor. You know, I mean, that's a much harder job. There are so many harder jobs, and I'm just very lucky and dare I say blessed to be doing what I do.
Mm-hmm. And do you think it became easier to launch a journalistic career in the digital age or not really?
It became easier and it became harder. And there are two reasons for that. The reasons it became easier is because you can just start a blog and people will see it. That doesn't mean they will, but they can. the access is much easier. You don't have to be published in the New York Times or a local newspaper or Time Magazine or whatever the big magazines are these days. To be seen and to be read. Social media, and it's the same is true for music, for artists and entertainers of all kinds. It gives you a direct connection with whoever you can get to pay attention. Having said that, the internet made it so much harder to make a living as a freelance writer because the information that you possess that makes you a specialist is available everywhere. It's on Wikipedia. Wikipedia didn't exist before the internet. So that information that used to make you special is so much more readily available. And it made it much harder to get paid because print magazines, print newspapers still usually pay much better than websites do. Mm-hmm. And also look at what's happened to newspapers and magazines and publications. Like they don't have a physical product to sell anymore. So that is drastically cut into what they can earn and thus what they can pay their writers. So it's been, on the one hand, very liberating for truth in journalism or whatever, but it's also been very, very liberating for lies. And it's been very liberating for anyone to have a platform without necessarily being, I don't want to say qualified, but like being worthy of being listened to. And look at the United States for no shortage of examples of that.
And as a journalist, you talk to a lot of people, you take a lot of interviews, you write a lot of stories, but do you enjoy giving interviews yourself?
Actually, I do. I do. It's my dad gets excited when he sees me on TV. I hear from,
I hope your dad is listening to the podcast as well.
He's not so big on podcasts and network TV. He just thinks is the biggest thing in the world. And if ever I'm on Good Morning America or something like that, I hear from people like that I went to high school with, I haven't heard from for decades. All of a sudden there's these Facebook friend requests. So that's flattering. But more to the point, what I find is that talking about an issue I'm reporting on in a Q&A format, being asked questions, really focuses my thinking. And because, you know, when you're thinking, and you know this because you do podcasts, when you're thinking in bites. You're thinking in like, you know, 4 or 5 sentences, sum it up, get to the point and get out. Okay. And that really helps my writing a lot, at least my news writing. And what I often do is after I've done a TV spot talking about something, because I know they're going to use 10 seconds of it, sometimes more, sometimes half a minute, sometimes a minute, but usually they're just using a couple sentences from you. I just take what I said and I turn it into a story that's an overview while it's still fresh. So it's useful and yes, it's flattering. So.
And what would you say are your life highlights?
Oh my God. My life highlights, good Lord, my children, my family, traveling, things like that are really the real life highlights. But music has been such a huge, huge, huge part of my life ever since I was standing up in a crib and yelling out for a song. And it's brought me a lot of my best friends or connected me with a lot of my best friends. Some of my best times, when my daughter was little, because she's as obsessive about music as I am. She doesn't care about the music that I like or most of it, but you know, she's all about hip hop, she and her boyfriend. But when she was younger, like, you know, I noticed that she liked girl singers and she seemed to like pop music a lot. So I was like, okay, let's see how she likes ABBA. And for the next 2 years, she was obsessed with ABBA. She would have like my iPod and she'd be singing along at the top of her lungs. And I remember for her 7th birthday party, we were walking down the street and she goes, "So Daddy, I don't know if I want my birthday party to be a Hello Kitty party or an ABBA party." And I said, "You're having an ABBA party." And like, I tried buying ABBA posters, but they were all vintage and really expensive. So I just like, you know, printed some pictures off the internet and went to the party store and got these disco decorations with like stars and silver and glitter and stuff like that. And the, you know, we had an ABBA party, and like the other 7 really year olds didn't quite get it, but they all like dancing. So it's things like that. Yeah.
Yeah. I had ABBA period as well in my life.
Listen, do not look down on ABBA. Okay. ABBA's lyrics are, you know, English is a second language, insipid and kind of trite sometimes, and you have to get past that. But they are some of the most musically sophisticated pop music that has ever been made. It is up there with the Beatles. It is up there with the greatest pop music ever made. The key changes and the references and, you know, like these classical references and all these European things that Americans don't get, like mm-hmm. Schlager, you know, the German pop music and classical references and things like that. They're just brilliant. And I can listen to them again and again and again and always find new things in them. And Agnetha Fuchskog and Annefrid Lyngstad, the two singers, some of the most beautiful harmonies you'll ever hear. Incredible, incredible singers. I love ABBA.
Legends, legends. What can we say? And what is your personal definition of success?
Oh, geez. Doing good in whatever context that is and whatever it means. For me, that tends to be reporting on and helping the music community and musicians. That's my job. And of course, it's taking care of your family and leading a good life. And I don't get religious much, but I am a Christian. And I do, not that, you know, if I were Muslim or Jewish, I'd be saying the same thing. There are basic things about being a decent human being that I think are a big part of religion. And I try to stick to those. So that to me is success.
Love it. At the end, I ask some very quick questions.
Okay.
So do you have any book, movie, and song recommendations for our listeners?
Oh, dear Lord. So many, so many. What I'm going to do is I'm going to email you some links because, I mean, I could tell you some of my favorite records right now. My favorite song so far this year is by a young R&B singer who calls himself Q, which has to be the least Google search friendly artist name in history. But it's called I Want to Be Where You Are, something like that. Just this beautiful, beautiful R&B song that's a lot like Childish Gambino's song Redbone. Just wonderful. My favorite albums were by the British group Salt, S-A-U-L-T. Like very contemporary R&B, but you know, different. Mm-hmm. Very, very cool. And the Avalanches, an Australian DJ combo that just makes these masterpieces of albums out of just thousands of samples. And the new album has guest singers, which their previous ones didn't anywhere near as much. And there's just like all these different people singing on the album. And their music is so interesting. Both of those groups, Salt and the Avalanches, their music is so interesting. I can just listen to it all day. Books, I'm going to send you my Goodreads list because I read probably 20 novels a year. And I would be worried about leaving some of them out. Yeah, I'll just send you the list.
Okay. And I will share it with you guys on Instagram. obviously you met a lot of celebrities already. Is there anyone that you haven't met already or haven't done an interview yet, but really would love to?
Oh, there are so many. But part of the thing is the artists that you really love, if they're assholes, you don't, you know, it's hard still to love them. And as much as you try to be a professional and separate the fan from the journalist, whatever, you still remember that because music is about how it makes you feel. So partially for that reason, I never interviewed David Bowie and I never interviewed Prince, who are really, along with the Beatles and the Rolling Stones, my two favorites. I would love to interview the Rolling Stones. I would love to go deep, not just about their music, but also about their business, because especially in the last 30 years, the Rolling Stones have been far more visionaries with business than they have with music. I mean, their music's fine, whatever. You know, they certainly made their mark. Their music in the last 30 years has been fine. Their music before that is genius. But, you know, sponsored tours, you know, the ways that they've just rolled out the catalog, all kinds of different ways, the merchandising opportunities. There are so many things they did for the first time that people don't know about. So I would love to interview them. I've only met one of them and once. It was Keith Richards. It was at a record release event that he was at. And one thing that's funny is, like, with these big stars, like members of Led Zeppelin and things like that, journalists in their 50s and 60s and even 70s, like, they clam up. They get starstruck. And you can tell they're just like, So I'm introduced to Keith Richards. There's like four people standing around him and everybody's nervous and nobody's asking questions. And I'm like, all right, the hell with this. So I just start, we were at Electric Lady Studios. I'm just like, Keith, you know, how did the album come together? You know, I mean, were you intending to record an album? Whatever. He's like, and he goes into his usual line, like, you know, like, ah, blah, 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 whatever. Said, well, we're at Electric Lady Studios, and I know you've worked here a lot, but were you ever here with Jimi Hendrix, who built the studio just before he died? And Keith Richards, he says to me, well, I remember him talking about it, and I said to him that I'd like to work here sometime if he'd have me. And he puts his arm around me and he's laughing. And I just love that Keith Richards, like, wanted to make me laugh. So, you know, so it's things like that. Moments like that are really, really special and you can't really plan.
But were there some moments when you were very disappointed in the artists when you were taking the interviews and you got to know them better?
It's the same as meeting people, really, although, you know, there's a lot more on the table, you know, and you also don't know if they're having a bad day or they're just tired of doing interviews or, like, you're accidentally asking the same six questions in the same order that the person before you did, you know, because that's very hard. It is very hard to continue answering the same questions and make it interesting. You know, the people who have been unpleasant or not particularly nice, it kind of came with that. Like, you know, I mean, the worst interview I ever did was with Perry Farrell of Jane's Addiction, who is kind of notorious for that. You know, and I could have caught him on a different day and he could have been great. And I knew that, but the interview actually came out very funny with us kind of snipping at each other. My friends really liked it. But it's mostly that. And usually artists are not going to be unpleasant, because they don't want it to reflect badly on them. They know they need the press. More often, they're going to be not too nice, but overly nice. And, you know, like, oh, what a great question. Wow, you're absolutely right. You know, I mean, things like that. And I'm hamming it up a little bit. But you can feel when it's genuine. And you can feel when it's going on, you know, both off the rails or like into someplace different, you know what I mean? And that's when it gets exciting, when you're like really having a conversation and it's not question, answer, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Thank you. Another question that I have, what is the most useless talent that you have?
Oh, I've got plenty. A selectively photographic memory for certain things. Okay, I can tell a friend a joke he made when we were 19 years old, and that's decades ago. I can tell you, this is really for you, and it's music. It's a music memory too. When I was 10, 11 years old, there were these late night concert shows on American Network TV. They were on at 11:30, 1 a.m. sometimes on, on network television. That was past my bedtime. So I'd wait till my parents had gone to bed and I would sneak downstairs and watch them on TV. And I'd see like Kiss and Sly and the Family Stone and all these amazing artists, some terrible ones too. I can tell you songs they were playing. I can tell you songs I didn't even know that they were playing. Because, and I'll remember things. It's like, you know, for instance, I remember seeing Roxy Music when I was maybe 10. And they did a song that went like, blah, 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 you know, and I know now that song is Do the Strand. And there are things like that. I mean, what the hell is wrong with me? How do I remember that? And if I remember that, why can't I remember like a binary code for like a cure for COVID?
That's so funny. And the last question that I always ask my guests is, who inspires you the most?
Oh, my family, of course. They're the reason you do everything. And as is true of all families, the way you see yourself reflected back in them is a really touching thing. And I don't just mean my immediate family. Like over Memorial Day, my extended family, my sister's family and my dad and my family and my dad and I, we're all together for the first time since COVID at my dad's house. And my niece, who's 14, she had been interested in getting a record player. And my sister had asked me for advice. I said, just get her a nice Crosley or whatever. And she just happened to mention, she said, yeah, I have the record player and I love it, but I don't have very many records. And of course, I've got hundreds of records still at my dad's house. So I'm like, okay, Tess, let's get you some records. So pulling all these records out, and I gave her a stack of like this many. And I'm like, do you want this? Do you want this? Do you want this? And she took almost every single one. And things like that are super inspiring.
Love it. Thank you so, so much. Thank you for your time. Of course, I know you're super busy. Thank you for finding time and doing this. Thank you so much for sharing your story with us. I'm just so happy we did it. Thank you so much.
So am I, Sofiko. And send me a link when it's done. I will send you those links later today. And best of luck to you.